every time I do this, at least one person will come up to me and say basically, oh man, dude, oh, I loved your talk, but you know, the Jersey Devil's real, man. I saw it in the woods. And you know, there's no comeback for that. There's no witty rejoinder when an 80-year-old lady comes up and says, you know, I saw the we were stopped on the Jersey on the Parkway at a rest stop, and I saw the Jersey Devil in the woods. You know, what am I supposed to do? Intellectually bludgeon an 80-year-old?
I'm Paige.
And I'm Megan.
And this is Spooky Science Sisters.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hello, you are listening to episode 26 of Spooky Science Sisters, a podcast where we present to you a science-based and probably very giggly discussion on all things strange and unusual. Before we introduce today's guests, we want to remind you of a few ways you can support the show. This includes several free options like sharing with a friend, subscribing, and leaving us a rating and a review. We also recently started a Buy Me a Coffee account, which is linked in the show notes. You have the option to either make a one-time donation or become a member and support us monthly. There are some perks associated with each of these options, so if you're interested in helping the show grow even more, please check that out.
For this episode, we are joined by a guest, Dr. Brian Riegel. Brian is a science history professor at Keene University in New Jersey, a skeptic and writer. He has published books on both Sasquatch and the Jersey Devil, and is here with us today to discuss the origins of cryptozoology. So Brian, welcome. We're super excited. Before we get started, can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell them a little about your background and the work that you do?
Sure. Thanks for having me on. My name is Brian Riegel. I'm associate professor for the history of science, technology, and medicine at Keene University in New Jersey. And I teach about and write a lot about the more dubious realms of the history of science. My doctorate is in modern history and literature with a specialty in the history of science, which means I can explain to you why climate change is real, why vaccinations are safe, why evolution is real, and I can do it all while quoting the romantic poets.
That's great.
Oh, and, and despite what I write about, I've never seen a ghost, never seen a UFO, I've never seen anybody spontaneously combust, although I've wanted certain people to do that right in front of me, and it never works.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no such thing as Sasquatch, Bigfoot, or the Jersey Devil.
Oh, okay.
I usually like to get that out of the way, you know, right up front. You know,
yeah, because I'm sure that's
that, just so no one gets fooled that they think I'm going to do something other than that.
Yes. Yeah. we figured. yeah. But importantly, Brian is another guest who's probably too fancy to be on our little podcast, but we're excited about it.
That's okay.
We did go and look at your CV that you have online, and I was tickled to see that you have on there that you were accused of being the Antichrist in sixth grade.
Yes, Sister Louise, my nemesis in Catholic.
That's awesome.
Yeah, one time we had to draw in art class. We had to draw pictures of our favorite saints, you know, because mm-hmm. Catholics are into saints. And so I decided to do Saint Lucy, and I drew her holding a switchblade. I don't know if you know the story of Saint Lucy. In order to not have to marry a pagan prince, she took a knife and she gouged out her own eyes. Make unattractive. And when Sister Louise saw me draw Lucy with a switchblade, she threw the book at me. And I mean, literally, she picked up a book and threw it at me and hit me in the head with it.
Oh, my gosh.
So there's my life.
I mean, it sounds like you were being pretty accurate to the story, though. So
that's what I thought, you know.
Oh, man. Yeah. And then I also saw that you teach a course called The History of Pseudoscience in America and poked around online.
I'm doing that course this semester right now, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I saw that. I was able to, from your website, you get the link to the syllabus and stuff like that. So that sounds like a super awesome course. So
it is, actually.
I'm very jealous that these were not options when I was in college. I don't think Albion taught anything like that. Did they, Paige?
No, not that I know of. I can't say at the time that I necessarily would have, you know, looked, but I mean, going back, like I wish that I would have gone to a school or had thought to take classes like that, because that sounds far more interesting than some of the classes I took.
I also do a course on the history of alchemy.
That's super cool.
How cool.
Yeah, which that was one of my later silly questions that we had written down, was that since you do stuff with history of science and alchemy, I was like, oh, have you met any mysterious vampires in your time?
No, but I was threatened by a werewolf once.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well, there you go. A few years ago, I wrote an article for a British magazine called The 40 Times. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
If not, you should be. It's terrific. Mm-hmm. But I wrote this article called Where Have All the Werewolves Gone? In which I looked at how in the past, in the early modern period, werewolves were something people were afraid of actually literally running into in the woods.
Okay.
And now that's not really a thing anymore. Mm-hmm. But what people are afraid of running into in the woods now is like Bigfoot or Sasquatch. And so the one monster has been replaced by the other one. And, I got a lot of interesting feedback, and, this woman from Brooklyn wrote to me, very angry. And she said, I'm just another one of these egghead scholars. I get yelled at a lot on social media. And she said, I should be ashamed to call myself a professor because I don't know what I'm talking about. Werewolves are real. And I should be very careful that I don't make werewolves angry because they'll come and visit me in the middle of the night. And she finished her letter by saying the reason she knew all this was because she herself was a werewolf.
Ah, of course.
That was fun.
Interesting.
Yeah. And like safe to say they have not come to find you.
No, not yet. I've been saved that fate.
Yes.
Lucky you.
Yeah. So I ask about the vampire because you might not be familiar with, but Paige and I, well, I just got done reading it. Paige is in the middle, but we read the Discovery of Witches series, which she is, the main character is like a historian of science. And
oh, really?
Specifically, I'm familiar. Yeah. She specifically does like history of alchemical stuff and but anyway, it's like, you know, she meets a mysterious vampire and they fall in love and
so as one does.
In our one of our previous episodes, I described it as a mature Twilight. So
you know, the funny thing about Twilight is that so you have the hot sexy vampire and the hot buff sexy werewolf, and they're fighting over the girl. That's so unrealistic, because if a vampire and a werewolf were fighting over a girl, they wouldn't be fighting over her to see who gets to be in love with her. They would be fighting over her to see who gets to kill her and eat her. So totally unrealistic.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, well.
So in our intro, we did, you know, call you a skeptic, but I think it's important to note that in many of the interviews that I've listened to, I think Megan's listened to quite a few of them as well, with you in them, you have stated specifically that you are not a debunker.
No, I'm not.
And so I'd like if you could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. Well, I'm not a debunker. The Wall Street Journal once called me a debunker, but no, I'm a historian. Mm-hmm. I don't go out to my mind. A debunker is someone who intentionally goes out to prove that some belief system is invalid, to prove that UFOs don't exist or to prove that Bigfoot doesn't exist. And that's not what I do at all. I'm really uninterested in whether or not Bigfoot is real or the Jersey Devil is real. When Frank Esposito, my co-author, and I sat down to write the Secret History of the Jersey Devil, proving the thing was real or not was literally the last thing on our minds. I'm a historian. I'm a trained historian, and I approach all this material with the eye of a historian. To tell the story of whatever that phenomena, person's life, event is. And if what happens is I show that this thing is not there, or it's there in a way different from what most people think, you know, that's just the luck of the draw. I follow the evidence where it takes me. I'm not out to prove these things are real or not. So that's why I resist the label of debunker. I am skeptical about a lot of this stuff. But again, that's not really the point of what I do.
Right. Yeah. I was just trying to sit here thinking, like, are we even debunkers? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think we tend to go in every topic thinking we know that, like, it doesn't exist or that it's not real. Though several times through episodes, we get to the end and think, like, I don't know, maybe what we thought in the beginning was wrong. So so maybe we think we're debunkers, but we don't know.
I would say more like I feel like I go into each episode thinking I feel more positive that there could be something spooky going on. And then at the end, I'm like, no, this is not spooky at all. Or not paranormal at all.
I think that's one of the downside to this stuff, because a lot of these topics are kind of interesting and, you know, even romantic in a number of different ways. And it would be nice, I think, to believe that there really are 8-foot-tall, 700-pound hairy primates wandering around the Pacific Northwest. You know, or a strange sort of horsey thing with wings wandering around the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, or that people do actually turn into werewolves, or that witches can do some of the things. And it can be a little, disappointing when you find out not so much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've talked several times that there are several topics that we're like kind of wish did exist. It would be more fun.
Yeah. But we also talk frequently about how when you look into the real life stuff, sometimes it's like, well, that's scarier than whatever paranormal thing people say is going on. Okay. So do we want to move on to something spooky, Paige?
Yeah, sure.
Well, I am going to go first because I got very excited about this news story that came out. So Something Spooky has traditionally been us talking about if something spooky happened in our everyday lives, but turns out we have become boring.
Yeah. And Megan says she's going first, but, like, let me just tell you, nothing spooky happened to me this week. So, like, Megan's just gonna, Megan's just gonna go.
Yeah. So I was like, fine, this week, it will just be sort of spooky news. So it's still something spooky. It's just, you know, didn't happen to us. It's just news related because I really loved this story. So I found an article that I thought was appropriate for today called "For Centuries, Big Sur Residents Have Seen Dark Watchers in the Mountains," which was published on the San Francisco Gate website. And it's interesting because other articles and people are now saying, like, oh, are these like a new cryptid? And I've seen a lot of people in sort of the, you know, paranormal podcast cryptid Twitter sphere posting about it. So apparently, if you look up on mountain ridges in the San Lucia mountain range in California, and particularly at dusk, you might see large figures silhouetted against the sky that are apparently up to 10 feet tall and sometimes wearing, like, appear like they're wearing hats or cloaks. And I guess that there are, they say there are centuries of legends about them, including from the Native Americans from the area. The Spanish explorers who showed up in the 1700s called them Los Vigilantes Oscuros, which is the Dark Watchers, and others have since cited them and just like reported feelings of being watched from the hills above them. So that's just creepy and fun.
But they sound well-dressed.
But they sound well-dressed, yeah.
they're stylish.
Yes, yeah, the hats and the cloaks. Yes. Okay. So I thought it was really interesting that everybody was sharing them and people were starting to say, like, you know, people were supposed to be like, oh, have you heard of this? Like, is this a new, you know, a new like sort of weird cryptid or whatever? Because the article specifically addresses, like, it wraps up with talking about how skeptics might explain them. So it was just sort of like an interesting, I don't know, an interesting like sociological thing, or I don't know what it is, but that me reading the article, I was reading the skeptical explanations and thinking, like, this seems super reasonable. But like my sense is that a lot of people that were sort of connected to on social media were like, oh my gosh, there's mysterious creatures in the mountains that like actually exist. So yeah, so I thought it was appropriate for today. But the two, before we chit-chat about that, the two skeptical explanations for these was what I thought of immediately. One was that it was just pareidolia relating to like your eyes seeing shadows, like long shadows from trees on the ridges that are obscured by fog or mist, and especially since they're often seen at dusk or dawn, that it's just like your brain is saying, oh, that's a person standing up there, but it's not really. And then apparently there's also something called a Brocken specter, which is named for a particular phenomenon on Brocken Peak in the Harz Mountains in Germany. And this is a quote from the article, but it says, it happens when shadows, like those of a hiker, are cast on particularly misty mountain peaks. If the sun is behind the observer, the mist plays with the shadow, making it look huge and menacing. The shadow can even dart away as the mist suddenly shifts or breaks apart in the breeze. And that's like part of this. People will be like, you know, they'll all of a sudden go away really quickly. So I was like, yep, that seems reasonable. Like, it's just people like either seeing shadows of a hiker or another person, or their brains are just saying like there's something there. And also just like the feeling of being watched, it's like, well, you're like in these like misty mountains at dusk and like things are kind of creepy, like that just seems like, I don't know, normal stuff. So anyway, that's my thought.
Okay,
so Brian, did anything spooky happen to you recently that you wanted to share?
No, I, you know, as I said before, I've had, no real spooky stuff ever happen to me. I've never seen a ghost.
Oh yeah.
you know, I never saw a UFO or anybody levitating. And you know, I feel left out sometimes because, I haven't had these experiences.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It would. Well, we said lots of times that it's like, I just want to see a ghost or something. Well, we can move on to our discussion of cryptozoology. So Paige, do you want to start us off with that?
Yeah. And first things first, we just want to kind of talk about what cryptozoology is. And we've discussed a couple of cryptids on previous episodes. We did do a full episode on Sasquatch, which I believe was episode 6. And I think it was that same episode that we had mentioned the Loch Ness Monster as like one of our short and spookies at the end of the episode. We'll definitely do more in the future on specific cryptids. But for today's episode, we wanted to focus specifically on the origins of cryptozoology. So what is it? It's the study of and search for animals, and especially legendary animals, usually in order to evaluate the possibility of their existence. And these legendary animals are referred to as cryptids.
Yeah, and I just wanted to point out that the base word for that cryptic is used elsewhere in science for variations that can't be seen with the naked eye. So, for example, I come from an igneous petrology background, which is the study of igneous or either volcanic or magmatic rocks. But you can have these deposits that have what we call cryptic zoning, which is where their chemical composition varies across, you know, whatever outcrop or deposit you're looking at, but there's no visible evidence to the naked eye. So yeah, it's sort of an example of like co-opting a scientific term a little bit for something that's a little bit more pseudoscience. But cryptids span a range of plausibility from, you know, the belief that, you know, another hominid or primate is roaming around the wilderness like Bigfoot, to what I would think are more dubious things, like there's a winged Mothman who has some mythical power to foretell an upcoming disaster. Yeah. So I guess my first question just about cryptozoology for you, Brian, is related to like, why do you think people are just so eager to believe in their existence? Like, for example, I read a statistic that 16% of Americans believe in Bigfoot. And there have been like over 400 sightings since the 1940s.
As a historian, I don't really, that's, I think, more of a psychological question. Why?
Yeah, sure.
But I, you know, as I said before, I think there's a certain romantic aspect to it. The idea, I think what I've talked to a lot of people, self-described cryptozoologists over the years. And I think one of the things which attracts them is the kind of adventure aspect of going out into the woods and, you know, spotting one of these creatures that some people say is real and some people say it isn't, you know, the sort of the thrill of the hunt kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And humans seem to have been seeing strange creatures. I'm sure our Australopithecine ancestors saw weird stuff in the shadows at night that scared the crap out of them. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to be a kind of universal, no matter where you go in the world, regardless of ethnic background or religious, background, people see weird stuff. It just mm-hmm. seems to be a human trait. It may be an evolutionary adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
To help us survive, that if we see stuff that seems a little peculiar, mm-hmm. our reactions often to back away from it,
mm-hmm.
and that can be a survival tactic. The way humans always see faces everywhere.
Yeah,
and that is likely some sort of evolutionary adaptation, survival adaptation, so that when you saw another creature like yourself, you would know, oh, okay, this is a friend. And when you saw a 1,500 pound cave bear, you know, not a friend. I should try to go up to it and talk to him because that could be dangerous. So, you know, our brains evolved. We're constantly, as we move through our environment, we're constantly looking at things and we're constantly seeing faces because our brains have evolved to do that in order to be safe.
Yeah, and I've definitely heard similar things to that before. And it's funny because It's funny that you mentioned, that concept of like potentially evolutionary or related to evolution or part of our background, that we sort of fear things that are unfamiliar, because I've been listening lately to a couple podcasts, which is sort of unrelated, but that talk about like black-eyed children, because I was thinking like we should do this on here. But yeah, it's like sort of just that idea that like, oh, it's something that's sort of like us, but also it's just there's something wrong here. They're a little bit different, or like all the, yeah. Anyway, and the other thing about Bigfoot, I think that you mentioned and that we had learned when we did the Bigfoot episode some time ago was that, yeah, like some of it is this sort of romantic idea of like, you know, here's this creature that's survived all this time and like can just live in the wilderness and like hasn't been, you know, destroyed by us. So it's like romantic notion of like living out in the woods and doing your own thing, I guess.
Something that I wanted to say earlier, you had mentioned that like 16% of Americans believe in Bigfoot. And I just like, that's a crazy number to me, because I don't know that I guess I haven't asked everybody I've met, hey, do you believe in Bigfoot? But I can't say that I currently, like family members, friends, have anybody that I know that believes in cryptids in general. Do you know anyone, Megan? I'm assuming, Brian, you've probably met like all sorts of people who.
Sure. Yeah.
And like gotten some angry emails about it.
Oh, yeah. I give talks on this. Well, not in the last year, but, in the before time, I regularly give talks to at libraries and civics groups and such. And it's a fascinating thing, because I'll get up there and I'll give this 45-minute talk with slide, PowerPoint and everything. And when it's over, there's always the line of people who want to come up and, speak to you personally and, oh, thanks for coming. And I loved your talk and all that. And inevitably, every time I do this, at least one person will come up to me and say basically, oh, man, dude, oh, I loved your talk, but, the Jersey Devil's real, man. I saw it in the woods. And there's no comeback for that. There's no witty rejoinder when an 80-year-old lady comes up and says, I saw the we were stopped on the Jersey on the parkway at a rest stop, and I saw the Jersey Devil in the woods. What am I supposed to do? Intellectually bludgeon an 80-year-old? that's interesting. Really, you saw it? Okay, well, great.
Neat.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Get lost,
Granny. Yeah. Yeah. That's so. Yeah, that would be really tough. Like, what are you even gonna say? Poor old woman who talks about this stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, really, how do you respond to anybody?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you asked me, like, do I know anybody, who, like, actually thinks? I don't think so. And I mean, 16% of Americans, like, if that number is right, is a lot. I mean, it's a lot of people. But it's also, like, compared to the number of people who believe in, like, ghosts, for example, like, I think that's, like, 50%, if not a little bit more.
Oh, yeah. I know like a ton of people who believe in ghosts.
Right.
Or that, like, alien abductions, even.
Yeah. Which is funny to me, because we talked about this before. Like, scientifically, I think Bigfoot is one of the more likely things to actually exist. Like, do I think that it does? No. But. In terms of like it being possible.
Of all the various cryptids, Bigfoot is the one which is, from an evolutionary standpoint, the most plausible, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's real. I've never seen any evidence where, I'd like to think I'm a fairly honest guy. I've looked at lots of photographs, supposed photographs of Bigfoot and mm-hmm. other anomalous primates and tons of video footage. And I've never seen one where I said, wow, that looks real.
Yeah,
right.
But it has the most plausibility to it.
Yeah, right.
If Bigfoot is real, it's a primate of some kind.
Right. Yeah.
And the fossil record is fairly clear that there were some rather biggish primates in the fossil past. Mm-hmm. And so it's not completely out of the realm of possibility.
Mm-hmm.
The Jersey Devil, on the other hand, it is so against everything we know about evolution. You can't have a quadruped with wings.
Yeah.
it's not really a quadruped then. It's what would it be with six arms? And then you get into all kinds of problems about, okay, well, if it's got, four legs and it's got two wings, the wings are arms and legs as well, which means you have to have a whole extra set of shoulder mechanics, which have to attach to a rib cage. And if you have a second rib cage, what goes inside the second rib cage? Is there a whole extra set of organs? So you just wind up going down this road where it just gets increasingly mechanically, anatomically improbable, so
right.
There's no Pegasus, there's no, what are the word just flew right out of my head, the half horse, half human.
Oh, a centaur.
Centaur, thank you.
Yeah.
same thing.
Yeah.
You have all these problems from an evolutionary anatomical point of view.
Right. Well, and like the other thing about the Jersey Devil is that like some woman gave birth to it or whatever, like in New Jersey. So
yeah, that's a bit problematic as well.
I don't think I knew that.
I didn't. And then like while I was looking at stuff for this episode, I'm unclear that I really knew what the Jersey Devil was before I started looking. I was like, wait a second.
There's a wonderful and informative book out.
There is.
That you might consider, checking on. Very, very, detail-oriented, exciting. It's an exciting read. you might check that out.
Well, and we still have to do a Jersey Devil episode. So I think when we get to that point, we'll definitely have to check that book that you're talking about out.
Yes.
It would be helpful. it's both fun and informative.
Excellent. Okay. But we won't make you talk a ton about the Jersey Devil because I know you've been doing a lot of that since the book came out.
I appreciate that.
Relatively recently, but I just wanted to point out how preposterous it is that it's like, this did not come out of somebody. Like, what is happening? Okay. What we're here to talk about. So that's, what cryptozoology is. And I'm sure we could keep talking about that forever, but you've done some really interesting work on sort of, I guess, where cryptozoology even comes from and like the origins of this. And you sent us an article that you had written called Richard Owen and the Sea Serpent, which was a really good read. So that was fun. But yeah, Paige, did you want to dive into that a little?
Yeah. And I put like a very, very brief kind of overview of the article. So please, at any point, Brian, jump in. And if you think I've missed something, or don't be afraid to cut me off. So the article covers, it really talks about a man named Richard Owen, who is a paleontologist in the 1800s. And basically, there are several sightings of what is considered a giant sea snake or a sea serpent. Owen believes that these sightings were just misidentifications of other animals. And for example, one of these sightings he says is probably just mating whales. Owen's belief was that paleontology and zoology should be based off of tangible evidence. So these eyewitness accounts weren't enough to say that this sea serpent existed. And so the sea serpent claim lacked evidence. So he rejected the sea serpent idea entirely.
Yeah. And I thought it was cool that this was that this is related to sea serpents, and like because of the times I had looked into stuff before that, like, if you look at old maps,
you know, they drew monsters in uncharted areas and even like real creatures like whales and stuff, they would draw with like having these sort of like monster heads on them. And, you know, you get a bunch of sailors out in the middle of the ocean and like maybe they think, you know, these are like normal behaviors, stuff like breaching and stuff like that, like might look aggressive or scary to them. So it makes total sense to me that, yeah, this guy would think like, no, you guys are just seeing whales. So anyway, Brian, yeah, do you have any, can you elaborate, I guess, some on, you know, the path that Richard Owen took in terms of reaching these conclusions, or like how he, you know, came around to sort of reject this concept that we can rely on eyewitness reports?
Yeah, Richard Owen was a very well-known English paleontologist, biologist in the latter half of the 19th century. Contemporary of Charles Darwin and T.H. Huxley and all those sort of golden age evolution guys. And he was well known in his time publicly. He was a tutor to the Queen's children, so he had political clout. And, he helped found the British Museum. So he's someone with a lot of bona fides and public knowledge and political clout. Mm-hmm. And because of that position, he starts getting sent by the British Admiralty. They were getting these reports from ship captains and even warship captains about seeing these strange animals. And so the British government started funneling these reports to Owen for sort of comment. And what I found fascinating about this was that the reason the British government gets interested in this is because they think, maybe you can make money off of this. We hunt whales and we make money off of whales. Maybe we could start hunting sea monsters. And maybe there's some aspect of sea monster anatomy that we could cash in on.
Great.
Maybe a special kind of oil or something. And so they felt this was worth looking at. Mm-hmm. And so Owen is getting all this, and he gets some of the most famous reports of the day, probably the most famous historical sea monster report, that of the HMS Daedalus, which was a British warship on a cruise coming home from the Mediterranean. And in the 1850s sometime, you could double check that. And they see what they think is a sea monster. And the captain writes up a report and puts it in his logbook and sends it in. And so Owen gets a hold of this and looks at it. And he decided that, well, there's no evidence. One of the things that annoyed Owen about all this was that the people's willingness to say, well, a British sea captain would never lie.
Yeah.
a British sea captain is sober and intelligent and wouldn't exaggerate and all of this. Mm-hmm. And so if the captain says he saw this thing, it must be real.
Mm-hmm.
And so Owen was like, well, wait a minute. Just because somebody is a sea captain doesn't mean they can't be fooled or they could lie. So he was really one of the first people to argue against accepting these sort of sightings because of eyewitnesses alone. He had a problem with the whole concept of eyewitnesses. So he had a bunch of these. He was sent a bunch of these reports, and I found in the British Museum's library in their archive, Owen collected up all this stuff, letters that were sent to him, and drawings and newspaper articles, and he put them in this giant fat scrapbook that is there that you can go and look at with his notes on it. And essentially what he came to argue was that these were mostly misidentifications of mostly of sea mammals. And he thought that sea cows and other large sort of odd looking sea mammals that people didn't see very often, even people who were experienced at sea didn't see very often. You know, we often get this with people. Well, if this person has been living in, you know, up in the mountains, in the woods all their lives, they know the difference between a bear and a hairy primate. Maybe not. You know, just because you live in a certain place all your life doesn't always mean you're not going to see something, you know. Oh, a pilot, if a pilot says they saw a flying saucer, they must be right, because pilots are used to seeing things and they know what airplanes look like and all this. And so, you know, this was an issue. And Owen, in the scrapbook, there are these wonderful drawings that he does himself. He said, you know, I think what might, going by some of these descriptions, what some of these people might have been seeing were whales copulating. And he makes these incredible drawings, sort of crude little drawings. You know, he was not a trained artist, of whales having sex. And, you know, so when, as a historian, and you're going through this material, to turn a page and suddenly see these drawings of, you know, whale sex, it's, you know, it's one of the reasons why I love being a historian, because you find this stuff. And so he basically was arguing that there really was no believable hard evidence for these creatures.
Yeah. And I'm sure when you started studying this, you were like, oh, I did not expect to be like looking at crude drawings of whale sex. While I'm doing research.
You can't get yourself ready for something like that.
Yeah. Well, and I think when we talked to Chris Cogswell a couple weeks ago, that was, you know, one of the points that he brought up, the with aliens and stuff is people seem like they're so quick with, you know, reports of seeing cryptids or UFOs or whatever it is, to like sort of get affronted, you know, when you say like, oh, well, you know, maybe that was something else. And it's like, well, not, you know, people aren't lying. They just, you know, they don't know they've seen. Like, so yeah, it's just funny how people sort of like just get like entrenched in this idea of like, no, I definitely saw something weird. But anyway, your brain is weird. That's what we've learned doing this podcast.
Yeah, human beings are weird.
Yeah. And human beings are weird. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I guess related to, speaking of human beings being weird, speaking of weird drawings of whales, yeah, like what's the weirdest thing that you think you've come across, like looking into all these things?
Well, whale sex is, you know, that's up there.
Yeah.
That's the weirdest thing I ever came across. I'm not sure if it's weird, but it certainly is peculiar. There was, and I wrote about this in my Searching for Sasquatch book, there's this whole sort of cast of characters from the 1950s and 60s who are running around looking for Bigfoot here in North America. And there's a story about this guy, Rennie DeHinden, who was a Swiss Canadian who gets sort of fascinated by all this, and he decides to become a monster hunter. And he ran into he was sort of a volatile guy, and he ran into another monster hunter. This was in the early 1970s. Ran into another well-known monster hunter at the time, in the parking lot of a McDonald's, and they got into a shouting match and into a fist fight. So these two old coots, you know, like wildly swinging away at each other, and you know, fortunately nobody was really injured, but that was sort of peculiar. Grover Krantz, who my book is basically a biography of Grover Krantz, who was one of the few trained scientists who actually believed Bigfoot was real.
Yeah.
And he was a specialist in human evolution. And he did, along with his sort of Bigfoot publication. He did a lot of straightforward paleoanthropological writing about the evolutionary development of Homo erectus, one of our, as Homo sapiens, one of our more direct ancestors, fossil ancestors. And he was convinced that the heavy brow ridges of Homo erectus and like Neanderthals served some kind of purpose, some sort of evolutionary purpose. And he sort of hit upon the idea that maybe these really pronounced brow ridges acted as a kind of sunscreen, you know, keeping the sun out of their eyes, like wearing a cap with a bill on it.
Okay.
And so he created, based upon actual Homo erectus skulls, he made this kind of prosthetic, I'm not even sure what to call it, you know, brow ridge that he would glue to his forehead. And he would walk around. He was a professor at Washington State University, and he would walk around with this thing to kind of get a feeling of, does this sort of make sense? If I have this thing on my head, does it block the sun out? So you can just imagine this, you know, guy, professor, walking around campus with this thing on, and you know, people, just, students, just kind of staring at him. Oh, that's Professor Krantz. He's a little wacky.
That's such a great story, though. Oh man.
That's yeah, what I need.
I wonder though, like, I mean, don't, like, you know, like some of the other gray apes today, like, have pretty heavy brows. It's like, wouldn't you just ask, like, you know, somebody who studies gorillas or something?
Like, or ask the gorilla, because, you know, they have the gorillas now that can do sign language.
That's so true. Yeah. They might be able to tell, what does this do for you?
I'm sure Coco is ready to, you know, talk about something other than bananas.
Yeah. Or her. Coco's the one who has the kitten, right?
I think so.
Yes. This is just pretty awesome. Anyway, back to Richard Owen, though. So sort of what I think we took away from this, though, is that, you know, this is sort of like a turning point for the scientific community, and that they reject this idea of sea serpents, but like also, you know, other weird what today I guess we would call cryptids or unidentified animals. And this sort of like leaves a void that becomes cryptozoology, I guess. Like, would you say that that's right?
Yeah, that's around the time, I argue, that you start to get this major sea change in the scientific mainstream's approach to all this. You know, because we normally, the sort of standard history of cryptozoology, if you will, is that it really all sort of begins in the 1930s with the excitement about the Yeti in Nepal, and then it's sort of post World War II when Ivan Sanderson and Bernard Heuvelmans sort of coined the term cryptozoology. But the notion of scientific interest in monsters goes all the way back to the classical world.
Yeah.
You know, Aristotle, Ovid, Lucretius, they all wrote about monsters because they're trying to figure out, you know, this is in the kind of formative years of what will be called biology and zoology and ornithology. And so you have these guys running around who are trying to make sense of the diversity of life on Earth and kind of get it into some kind of order. And they are familiar with these stories of, you know, for lack of a better expression, monsters. And so for them, they didn't just sort of, you know, discount the whole thing. They too sort of accepted that, well, we get a lot of these reports, so there must be something in it. And logically speaking, if these creatures are real, even if some of them are real, they have to fit into this sort of broader picture of life on Earth. And if we can find a place for them to fit, we get a better idea of how life on Earth is organized. And mm-hmm. so they were perfectly willing to accept that these creatures might be real until they discover that they aren't. Mm-hmm. And so the notion of monster hunting for maybe that's not an appropriate maybe monster understanding, monster studies.
Yeah,
goes way back. And, you know, the term cryptozoology is sort of a mid 20th century invention.
OK,
but a lot of those guys, not just Richard Owen, but Charles Darwin, you know, he was interested in monsters because he was trying to figure out, how do you explain what is referred to at the time as generation? You know, where how do living things reproduce? Why do they keep going? And Darwin and others realized that while, yeah, you can learn a lot about the development of life by looking at, for lack of a better expression, normal living things, you can also learn just as much, if not more, from the sort of aberrations, from the abnormal. Mm-hmm. And so he was very interested in that. In fact, I was doing when I was working on this project, this long-term project, I was at Cambridge in England, because they have all of the vast majority of Darwin's stuff is at Cambridge in their library. Mm-hmm. And they have a copy of a book by a French author of the day, and who wrote a book about monsters, animal monsters, human monsters. And Darwin was fascinated by this, and they have Darwin's personal copy of Saint-Hilaire, Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire. You have to say it with an outrageous French accent.
Yeah.
And he was a well-known author. You know, he's still Saint-Hilaire is still studied when you study the history of evolution and biology. And he wrote this book about abnormal births and things. And Darwin had a personal copy of it, which I've held in my hand.
That's
and it's
so cool.
Full of Darwin's marginalia, where he's writing in there saying, you know, this is fascinating. You know, monsters can tell us a lot about the course of evolution. And so, all these researchers, all these philosophers did not immediately discount all this. They thought it was just one more part. One more normal part. Studying the abnormal was a normal part of studying the history of biology.
Yeah.
And it's not really until the 20th century that, in part thanks to the work of Richard Owen, that the mainstream begins to, you know, sort of drift. There'll be other stuff that will happen in the 20th century that pushes the mainstream even further away from this. But that's sort of the moment where that turn begins. And what happens is when all these, you know, again, for lack of a better expression, mainstream scientists and philosophers start leaving or lose any faith in any of this stuff. As you said, it leaves this big void, and into that void, you get all these amateur investigators show up. And that's when we really get the birth of modern cryptozoology.
Yeah.
That's when it stops being a part of the realm of the professional, and it becomes the realm of the amateur hobbyist.
Right. Speaking of Darwin, which that is like so cool that you've gotten to look at some of his personal books, and like presumably he had like you got to look at like journals and stuff like that as well.
Oh yeah, journals. I've seen the famous Notebook B. In which he makes that very first little drawing of a tree of life, where he writes over top of it, I think, next to the page where Einstein writes E equals MC squared for the first time. It's one of the most famous pages of a notebook in the whole history of science.
Right. So,
I've been lucky enough to see some of that.
How cool.
Yeah. That's awesome. And so one of the things that I had learned with respect to the Darwin stuff that you had talked about, I guess, on other podcasts, was that sort of one of the critical things that, you know, he led to the shift of ideas on was like basically like the idea of like werewolves phasing out, because people were like, oh, well, that's not biologically possible to have like a wolf human hybrid. Whereas things like Bigfoot, like we said, are more plausible.
Right. Yeah. That's, you know, I wrote this That's one of the things I wrote in that article, Where Have All the Werewolves Gone? That came from a presentation I did back in 2009. It was the 150th anniversary of the publication of Darwin's Origin of Species. And we were in England. They had a huge, I call it the Darwinopalooza, huge conference, you know, with all the leading Darwin scholars in the world were there. And I was lucky enough to have been invited to give a paper. And so I decided to, since everybody else was going to be very heavy and serious, I wanted to do something a little lighter. And I came up with this, this thing about how Darwin helps. He doesn't realize Darwin never talks about werewolves.
Okay.
But you know, his idea of natural selection showed that while yes, all living things are biologically related and different groups evolve out of other groups, you can't have things that are too far apart. You know, you can't have a dog that suddenly turns into a human or a human that suddenly turns into a dog. And so, I did it really as sort of tongue in cheek, not to be taken too seriously. And the next thing I know, USA Today runs this thing. You know, this is word about, you know, this guy who's talking. They called me up for an interview, and and then eventually, a couple of years after that, the show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, I wound up being a question answer.
Really? How cool.
You know, basically, you know, historian of science Brian Regal said famously that Darwin's work on natural selection helped end belief in which monster, you know, A, fairies, B, you know, this thing, C, or werewolves. And so it was funny because one of my students saw it.
Oh.
And I didn't even, you know, I didn't know it was going to happen, and said, you know, you were just on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a funny thing that happens sometimes where, you know, you put huge amounts of work. It takes me, like the Sasquatch book took me 5 years to write. The Bigfoot book took us, the Jersey Devil book took us, you know, 3 years to write. The way historians work, you have to be extremely careful and meticulous, and you have to go through the written record, and you have to read through boxes full of stuff to, you know, come to your point. And so it requires a lot of work. I love doing it, but it requires a lot of work. And there'll be times where, you know, I've put huge amounts of work into something, and it gets released and nobody cares about it. And then, I make this off the cuff remark about, Darwin and werewolves. And the next thing you know, I'm on USA Today.
Yeah.
You know, so you never know how this stuff is going to work. You know, you just do it and you hope maybe somebody out there sees it and, you know.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah, that's super neat.
So yeah, we came up with just a couple questions, like I said, that we wanted to ask you.
Okay.
Some of them might just be kind of silly, but my first question for you, just a heads up. So my first question for you, and I'm assuming I know the answer to this, but you know what assuming does. Do you have a favorite cryptid that you've studied or researched? My guess would be that, I mean, it would be Sasquatch or Jersey Devil since you've written books on them. But yeah, is there a specific cryptid that you say is your favorite?
Probably werewolves.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Well, you know, the werewolf is sort of a tragic character. The werewolf doesn't want to be a werewolf. They change it. If talking about this as if it's a real thing.
That's sad.
They don't change because they want to. They change. They are changed against their will, you know. And they never seem to get to wear, you know, nice clothes. Their clothes are always sort of ragged, as opposed to say vampires who are very stylish. they get the good clothes. The werewolves don't get the good clothes. So, you know.
I always assumed the werewolves didn't have the good clothes because, like, you know, they're they were turning into a wolf and, like, busting through them anyway. I was like, why would you wear your good clothes if, like, you knew that was going to happen?
Right. Oh, that just makes me sad for werewolves.
Yeah, yeah. Although maybe, you know, because I'm not sure if we, if Holly was totally familiar, but do you know why, like, werewolves and vampires are always, like, pitted against one another? Like, is there, like, a historical thing for that?
No, I don't think so. What people don't realize is that most of what people think is historical werewolf lore is really a product of 20th century cinema.
Oh, okay.
You know, even the most famous bit of werewolf related poetry was a complete fabrication on the part of the screenwriter for the 1930s werewolf. Even a man who is pure at heart and says his prayers at night can become a wolf when the wolfbane blooms and the autumn shines bright. Everybody thinks that's some sort of historic piece of literature, but it's not. The guy who wrote the screenplay for the original 1930s movie, The Werewolf, thought it up himself. He thought it would sound cool to have a witch kind of in the middle of the woods say this, and it would seem very sort of heavy, but yeah. It's all the silver bullet, the full moon, all that stuff. Is mostly made up. The idea of the werewolf goes all the way back to the classical world with the myth of Lycon, the king of Corinth, who tries to fool Zeus. He tries to test Zeus to see if Zeus is really as powerful as Zeus claims to be. And so he invites Zeus to dinner and gives Zeus a meat pie, which Lycon has made by murdering a child and grinding up the child and making a pie out of him to see if Zeus would recognize it. And of course, he does because he's, you know, Zeus. And he realizes that, you know, Zeus is outraged and he curses Lycon by turning him into a wolf.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's some aspect of this, like there's like cryptozoology, which is like, I don't know, trying to at least take like a pseudo-scientific look at these things and find some sort of actual evidence that these things exist. But like with all of these cryptids, there's also the flip side of, you know, there's just magic and like that's how they exist or get around or whatever. So, which like to the point of like Zeus turning him into a wolf, it's like, oh, this is just magic or a witch did it or whatever.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. If magic is real, like none of this even matters. Okay. One other thing that I came across with respect to sort of looking in myself to like origins of cryptozoology and stuff was I came across an article, a 2017 article in Cosmos, which basically sort of argued that like cryptozoology is sort of good for science in terms of like getting people interested in like conserving species and stuff and like in good in terms of like conservation biology. So this was like from an article in Cosmos called How the Search for Mythical Monsters Can Help Conservation in the Real World. And in that article, they note that more than 400 new species of mammals had been identified as of 1983. So this was between 1983 and 2017, which is quite a bit. And that there's a mathematical model suggesting that there are 160 mammals that have yet to be identified and like over 3,000 amphibians. So apparently there's a lot of little amphibians running around that we don't know about yet. But importantly, they note like given the loss of habitat and like environmental stresses that are so prevalent today that, you know, there's probably a significant number of species that have or will likely go extinct without having ever been identified, which, like, I could see someone who's into cryptozoology being like, oh, well, they just, you know, went extinct before we could find them. So I had a couple questions, one that is silly. One, we talked about this in our Bigfoot episode, but, and they address it in the Wild Thing podcast with respect to Grover Krantz, but she says that, like, he was sort of in favor of, like, if somebody finds a Bigfoot, they've got to kill it because that's the only way that we're going to prove absolutely that it's real is to have the body. So would you say that you are a kill Bigfoot in the name of science person or a Bigfoot conservationist?
Oh, well, you can be both.
Well, sure.
Krantz was a fascinating guy. And he outraged a lot of cryptozoologists by saying that very thing. And he used to go out driving around with a pickup truck and a rifle.
Yeah.
And his plan was, if I see one of these things, I'm going to shoot it. Because the only way you're really going to prove these things exist is if you drop one on a dissecting table at a university or museum. And you actually have to have one in order to prove they exist. And okay, sure, you wouldn't want to kill them all, but you know, you'd have to get one, you'd have to get a type specimen. And so, yeah, one of the reasons why I don't think they're real is because, you know, up there in the Pacific Northwest, in those regions where they do the logging, you have these big giant trucks barreling down the highways with the huge logs on the back. And in all these years, no one's ever run over one of these. I say this seriously.
Totally.
If they're really there, we should have had at least one example of one of these giant, 18-wheelers pulling into the local roadside diner with a Sasquatch splattered all across the front grill. and that hasn't happened yet.
So you would kill Bigfoot, though.
I suppose I would. I wouldn't want to do it myself personally, if that's
what happened,
you know? I think that's kind of what we've talked about, is like, think that obviously I would have to see a body to believe Bigfoot existed, but like, I don't know that I could personally do it. So someone else would have to for me.
Oh, man. Okay. So then the second thing, I think you'd be the right person.
Hate mail now.
Well, it's fine. we said it before. This was like episode 6 or whatever. We haven't gotten any hate mail yet, so it's fine. okay. So second, this idea that, you know, that cryptozoology sort of has this benefit in terms of getting people interested in, you know, endangered animals or like undiscovered animals and conservation. Do you feel like it has any benefit, or are you more on the side of like, no, like pseudoscience is destroying society right now? So like in terms of anti-vaxxers and all this stuff, because I feel like I wildly flip in between it. Like I sort of think like, some of the paranormal stuff and like cryptozoology stuff is like, oh, like, you know, this is cool. Like get the kids interested in investigating things. And even to go so far as like we talked about with like the Santa Claus episode, like it's good for kids to like figure out experiments, like that they can figure out whether or not Santa Claus is real and stuff. But then I also flip back to like, you know, people are ridiculous. I don't know. I just want to get your thoughts on it.
Well, again, you can be both. I do believe that a lot of pseudoscience is harmful. It's not just sort of a fun thing to, isn't that cute? They think the earth is flat. I think that anti-vaxxers and anti-maskers are a danger.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
if you saw the article a couple of weeks ago about the guy, I think it was in Wisconsin, the pharmacist of all people,
yes,
who destroyed the COVID, he was a flat earther.
Of course.
A Christian fundamentalist who believed that The sky is fake because it's something the government has created to keep us from learning about the flat earth. So yeah, there is that end of the spectrum.
Pharmacist. That just blows my mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that end of the spectrum is, you know, is certainly dangerous. There are even, you know, I'm working on this project now about the myths of who discovered America. A lot of that dovetails into white supremacy.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of really terrible stuff. Bigfoot, probably not so much, you know.
Yeah.
But I agree completely that I think it's a good thing.
Yeah,
that people go out there in the woods and you're not going to find a Bigfoot, I don't think. but if that gets people interested in conservation and biology and land reclamation, you know, and all of that, then it is a good thing.
Yeah.
As a kid, I watched as so many people of my generation who are interested in this sort of thing will say that, you know, I started watching In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they talked about some wacky stuff there, but that got me interested in it. It got me interested in reading more about history, and it helped lead me down the road to becoming a professional historian. And so that, you know, this idea that, you know, if searching for ghosts, let's say,
mm-hmm.
gets you thinking about bigger pictures of theology and existence, then maybe it's not such a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, so there, I do think there are aspects of this that are not, you know, that are down that less dangerous end of the spectrum that are actually, you know, we were talking earlier about how all these guys from the classical world, you know, like Aristotle and Pliny and Lucretius and these guys, they're looking for monsters. And they didn't find any, but in their search, they essentially invent biology.
Yeah, right.
They invent zoology and ornithology and geology.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, cryptozoology people haven't done anything like that yet, but that doesn't mean they might not in the future.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people often ask me, oh, should I, you know, my kid wants to go wandering around the woods looking for the Jersey Devil. Should I say, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You doing that might lead them to discovering some aspect of the cosmos that we're totally unaware of right now.
Yeah. Yeah. From that perspective, it's like, yeah, especially with kids, just like encourage their natural curiosity and yeah. Indulge it, I guess. I'm a geologist, so my parents are just let me wander around a lot when I was a kid looking for fossils. So
yeah, when I was little, my parents, my mother was a waitress, my father was a construction worker. I'm the first person in my family to become an academic.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was a little kid, my father bought me one of those little sets. I don't even know if they make these anymore. The little cardboard box with the bits of minerals and things glued into them with the names on them.
You can still get versions of them for sure.
And, you know, he bought me one of those and I thought it was the greatest thing I ever had. And I could play with it for hours.
Yeah.
I got this little book, which I still have actually floating around here somewhere. They used to make these things called golden guides.
Mm-hmm.
They're these tiny, tiny little like 3x5 soft cover books designed mm-hmm. for kids, each one on a different. There was one on astronomy and there was one on zoology. And I had the one on rocks and minerals
mm-hmm.
Written by this guy, Herbert Zim, who is largely forgotten today, but probably created more scientists and scholars than any other human being alive.
Yeah.
He wrote all these.
Yeah.
And he wrote them specifically for kids. And I was fascinated by the one on rocks and minerals because along with the chapters on, you know, what is an igneous rock and what is a volcano, you know, all that sort of mm-hmm. thing. There were chapters on how to become a geologist.
Yeah.
How to be a rock hound.
Oh, mm-hmm. How cool.
And, you know, they had pictures of these great little paintings of stuff. And he said, you got to get, if you're going to be a rock hound, if you're going to be a geologist, you got to get a proper geologist hammer.
Yeah.
And I had never seen one of these before. And so I went down to Mr. Fingers, which was one of these kind of stores we don't really have anymore, a kind of a general store where there's, you know, I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, and then Kearney across the river, you know, very urban, and it was kind of like a little, it had everything, and it had a little hardware section. And he had these little hammers that looked like a geologist hammer, but it was a tack hammer.
Okay.
But to me, you know, my 8-year-old self saw this and said, that's the thing Herbert Zim told me. Dr. Zim said I should have one of these. And so I scraped together 75 cents and I bought one, and I would go out on rock hunting expeditions. And one day my father sees me with this and he says, what's with the tack hammer? And I explained, and he said, oh, okay. And like a week later, he says, are you going to go out on your expedition this Saturday? I would always go out on Saturday morning, because there was a park down the street, and that was my that was my forest primeval, was this interstate park. And I said, yeah, I'm going to go rock hunting. He goes, here, well, this might help. And he hands me a brand new East Wing
professional-grade
geologist hammer.
Oh,
yeah.
That, you know, he when I said, where did you get this? He said, I got it from a guy off the back of a truck. Which is a thing that dads could do in Newark in those days.
Yeah.
And I still, in fact, I'm sitting in my home office and I'm looking at it.
Oh.
And it's dented and it's dinged and it's rusty and it's got the pits from, you know, 1,000 adventures in it. And, you know, that's one of the things that I guess, you know, maybe your parents did the same thing, you know, something similar for you to encourage you. They knew nothing about science. My parents knew nothing about science. They knew nothing about college. But I guess they thought on the kind of primordial level somewhere that this was a way I could keep from winding up going down a bad road, which is what most of my relatives and most of the people I grew up with did.
Yeah.
You know, and so when people say to me, you know, should I let my kid go out in the woods, or should I say, yeah, do that. Take him to a museum, buy him books. Yes. So yes.
There you go. Yeah. What you study. And it's funny because I mentioned that book, Discovery of Witches, and like, you know, the fact that she's like a historian of science and does this like stuff with like old alchemical texts and stuff. And they talk about her, like, I forget what library she's at, the Bodleian Library, which is
at Oxford.
Yeah. Like checking out, you know, different texts from there and stuff and looking at them. Anyway, that's beside the point. But I think like before that book, like I shouldn't have been surprised, but like, I was like, I don't think I realized that historians of science existed. And then it was like, we started doing the podcast and like got in touch with you, and it's like, here's a real life person who does this, and like, you're at this very interesting intersection between like, you know, science and history and culture, and you know, even like some of this stuff with like early settlers in America, or early people in America, like it's like an archaeology or, you know, anthropology thing. So yeah, it's like, it's pretty fascinating. It's pretty fascinating, and it's just like a super cool field to be in. So here we are once again with a guest, and I'm thinking like, what have I done with my life? But anyway.
Well, there's still time, you can catch up.
Yes. So I think that is sort of everything that I was hoping to cover. Brian, did you have anything else specific you wanted to talk about? Or, you know, is there anything specific that you'd like to plug, let people know where they can find you, stuff like that?
Sure. If you want to read all my books are on Amazon. The Sasquatch book is in paperback. The Jersey Devil book is in paperback. I do tons of op-eds and, you know, scholarly, you know, peer review articles and popular articles. And if you just Google my name, you'll get my Kane University website. And you can go through there and you can download a bunch of my articles and things and listen to podcasts that I've been on. Mm-hmm. When this is available, I'll be putting it on there too.
Oh, great.
So you can find out all about the weird stuff that I do. And if anybody out there wants to study the history of pseudoscience, Kane University is a terrific school, 4-year a state liberal arts college university here in New Jersey. We have one of the best history departments in the region. Give me a shout.
Yeah, go study cool stuff with Brian. is Kane is it undergraduate only or is it master's and PhD as well?
No, we have the whole thing. I'm in the Department of History. Mm-hmm. We do not, unfortunately, have a graduate program in history yet.
Okay.
But our undergraduate program is really excellent. We have incredible faculty, great facilities. The school just built us a purpose-built history center last year, which is where our offices are. The department offices, our special collections is in there. And so it's terrific. It's a great time to study this. And there's so much of it going on out there in the world that we need more people studying history. We need more people studying science. We need more people studying pseudoscience. It is a matter of national survival.
Oh, totally. That's one of the reasons I'm so glad we got to have you on here is we're, you know, on the science side and sometimes it's easy to see those. It's cool to see the intersection of those fields for sure, because I think that's really important. So yeah. Paige, do you have anything else you want to talk about?
I think that you've answered everything that we've had and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. If you want me to come back again, just let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like I said, the stuff with the Leif Erikson stuff and everything, it's like that is a whole other podcast episode. So I'm sorry we didn't get as much chance to talk about it today, but sure in the future.
All right. Well, as always, we'll be sure to post links to some of the articles that we have read of yours, Brian, as well as your, I think you have a website, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
If you just Google my name, usually the first thing that comes up is my university webpage.
Okay. All right. We'll link you to that and you can find all of his books and stuff there. So that wraps up this week's episode. Tune in next time for a full episode of Short and Spookies. If you're not sure what that is, in previous episodes, we used to do Short and Spookies to wrap up the episode. And so this time we're just going to do a bunch of those and push them all together as one episode. If you like our show, please hit subscribe and share it with a friend. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Spooky SciPod, Facebook at Spooky Science Sisters, and at our website, SpookyScienceSisters.com. If you have any questions about previous topics, ideas for future episodes, or any questions, email us at SpookyScienceSisters@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and stay spooky.
This podcast is a part of Straight Up Strange Productions. Discover more shows like this one at straightupstrange.com.
I'm Eliza, and I need you to listen to me. Have you ever felt so much that you don't know where to put it all? And you wonder if anyone would notice if you screamed? Because you want to. Scream for the ones they've hurt, the ones they've taken. Scream for yourself. These are my words, my story from my perspective. Because I know you'll hear other versions. Because I want you to have a chance to believe mine. Or at least hear it. If you're getting this, it's already over. But if one of you listens, really listens, it won't be for nothing.